Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 348 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Maggie Butt, also published as Maggie Brooks, speaks with Anne Morgan about the transition from being a published poet to an internationally published novelist, the resilience writing requires, and the challenge of choosing a pen name.
Maggie Butt was the Senior Royal Literary Fund Fellow at the University of Kent in Canterbury when I started my fellowship there. A published poet with an impressive track record, she was in the process of making the transition to published novelist with her first novel, The Prisoner's Wife. I was delighted to catch up with her to hear more about that experience.
So Maggie, in the time I've known you, you've gone from poet Maggie Butt to novelist Maggie Brooks with your novel The Prisoner's Wife coming out in numerous countries actually. How has it been to make that transition from poet to novelist?
I think I've always been a poet and a novelist. I just haven't been a very successful novelist up to now. So that I think I've always been a writer. I think I began writing pretty much when I began to read and discovered that I could make those lovely stories as well. So I've been writing poetry, been writing fiction. I have a number of unpublished novels under the bed and they're likely to stay there now, I think. So in a way, in my head, I've been writer rather than poet or novelist because I've been a journalist as well. You know, my writing's an academic, so my writing's always taken a lot of different forms. I've been very fortunate to be quite widely published as a poet in magazines and journals and collections, with 5 collections to date. And so starting to write a novel was really just a way of finding the right form for the material that I wanted to produce. And in terms of the name, Maggie Brooks was my maiden name, so I had that name for 30 years, so I was pretty familiar with that name. I was published as Maggie Butt as a poet, because that was the name that I'd then been using, and the people I knew me as Maggie Butt, so that seemed to make sense. And then the first conversation that I had with the publicist for The Prisoner's Wife, I went in and they were talking about marketing the novel in the States. And I said, OK, what about my name? I am aware that butt means arse in America. Is that going to be a problem? And she said, thank God you've raised it, not me. Is there another name that you would like to use for this book? And I thought, I'd really love to come up with a kind of Marilyn Monroe name. And I thought very hard and I came up with, everything I came up with was sort of Gwendolyn Biscuit or, I don't know, silly stuff. And then I thought, well, I need to be able to answer to this name if somebody comes and shouts for me in a hotel lobby. So what's the other name that I would answer to? And it's Maggie Brooks. So that was how I came to have these two names.
One of the things that I really admire about your writing is the way that you manage to find unusual perspectives on very familiar topics. So you've done it in your poetry, for example, Ali Pali Prison Camp, where you look at First World War, but through the eyes of a prison camp at Alexandra Palace, which I knew nothing about, 3,000 civilians held there. And then your lovely book, Sancti Clandestini, where you made up saints for your poetry. I mean, it's such a beautiful idea. But perhaps the most extraordinary example of this is your novel, The Prisoner's Wife, where you tell the story of the prison camps in the Second World War, but largely through the eyes of, or certainly through the perspective of, a young Czech woman who married a British prisoner of war and then spent a year, or slightly more than a year, posing as a British prisoner of war in those camps. Such an extraordinary thing. What lengths did you have to go to write that female perspective on what has traditionally been a very male story?
Well, thank you. I hope that I come at things from a different angle. Tell it slant, as Emily Dickinson said, because that's where the interest lies. That's where the interest lies for me. In terms of The Prisoner's Wife, I was just enormously lucky that I was in a lift at my mum's sheltered accommodation and an elderly gentleman said, "I bet I could tell you a story about the war that would make your hair stand on end." And immediately the journalist in me thought, "Ooh, okay." Started to talk to him and he told me this extraordinary story of the Czech girl who they had sheltered in the Nazi prison camp, hiding her in plain sight, dressed as a man. And he was interested in his perspective. He was interested in he and the other men having been noble and protected her and cared for her. But I, of course, was just fascinated by her story and how it had felt for her. So immediately, everything he's telling me, he told me about how she coped with her periods. But as soon as he began telling me those things, I was thinking, what was that like for her? What must that have been like for her? So the sort of imaginative stepping into her shoes was the first part of that. And then obviously kind of transposing all of the research that I did, all of the books that I read, the vast amount of research that went into it, into her perspective and thinking about what it was like for her. So, and I guess that's what we do all the time as writers, isn't it? Is try to inhabit other people's bodies, minds, and get a different perspective on the world in that way.
Mm. You did huge amounts of research, didn't you? Not just reading books, but actually going to many of the places that you write about in the book, because the prisoners moved around between different camps, didn't they? And then, well, when the camps were liberated, had to walk a long way. And, I mean, that was a big endeavour in itself, wasn't it? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, I started off, I don't know if I've ever said this to you, but I actually, after he'd given me all this information, I had about 6 pages of notes that Sidney Reed gave me from the story. And he didn't know what had happened to this couple. He had a postcard to say we made it home, so he knew that they'd made it back to the UK. But I don't know who they were. I've got still no idea who they were, and I'm hoping someone might come forward and say, "That was my grandparents." But he told me the story, and I did a little bit of research, and then I wrote it as a long narrative poem. Now, why I did that, I don't know. Nobody wants to read a long narrative poem. It's not a popular form. I had thought about writing it as a radio play, but I didn't have any experience in that. And I thought, if she's silent, if she had to remain silent, then you can't have a silent central character in a radio play.
That's right. Unless the character has to remain silent, doesn't she? Not yes. To give herself away. And
yes.
That's one of the key things in the book, so she couldn't talk.
No. Yeah. And in fact, my working title for the book was The Girl Made of Silence, and I still rather like that title. Anyway, so I did the research. I then wrote this long narrative poem, which was published online as a downloadable e-book, and a friend of mine recorded it, helped me record it, and so there was an MP3 to go with it. And then time passed, and I thought to myself, do you know what, that was brilliant story. I really ought to try and get that story out a bit further, a bit wider. So I then started some more serious research, novel type research. Obviously, Imperial War Museum and National Archives at Kew, joined the Lambsdorff Society, which was the camp in Poland that Sidney Reed had been at and that the Czech prisoner and her husband must have been at. And the more research I did, the more impossible this task seemed, because the more I discovered about the Second World War that I hadn't known before. I mean, my dad had been a prisoner of war, and so I did know some things that a lot of people don't know about the fact that everybody from non-commissioned officers downwards could be used to help with agriculture, factories, down the mines, by the Nazis. And in fact, most men found that they would rather be out working than trapped in a camp. So they actually, I wouldn't say welcomed that, but it was an alternative that they didn't hate. And I knew that. And one of the things Sydney had told me was that he had been at a quarry in Subikovice in Czechoslovakia, what's now the Czech Republic. And so that I knew that they had been there and working there. The prisoners had been working there. I knew that he had been at Lambsdorff. I then discovered through my reading that all of the Eastern European camps had been evacuated as the Red Army approached. And in January 1945, the camps were sent out. They were evacuated very quickly overnight, and the men were force marched out into terrible blizzards and marched perhaps 500 miles across Poland and then Germany. Why is a bit unclear, whether they were evacuated just so that the Red Army wouldn't release them and they would start to fight for the Russians. But it was also rumoured that Hitler wanted to use them as a human shield for his last stand. And when I discovered that my poor character, my poor Czech girl, was going to have to walk 500 miles in, you know, poorly clad and through one of the worst winters on record, temperatures of minus 20 degrees centigrade, I thought, I can't do this. I just can't do this. And then I thought, well, maybe if I went and saw it, I would be able to do it. So my husband came with me and we flew into the Czech Republic. We went and found locations. I don't know where she grew up. So we went and found locations for the farm that I have her growing up on. And then we drove up to Subikovice, to the quarry. We went and found a quarry. Don't know if it's the right quarry. Then we drove up to Lambsdorff. And by the time we got to Lambsdorff, it was snowing. This was the end of February, beginning of March, and it was snowing. So I saw Lambsdorff in the snow. And then we drove the 500 miles of the long march in the snow. And that was so atmospheric. I got out of the car, I walked in the snow, I put my head down in a blizzard, I felt where the snow blows into your face and what you can hear. And my husband drove and I just took photographs and notes. And when I got back, I thought, well, okay, I'm going to have a go at this. And that's what I did.
Wow. So in that case, the research was a real spur to writing for you then, those facts, that concrete detail, which I find really interesting because as a writer, I often like to get as far away from concrete facts as possible. The more I write, the more I tend to move away from real settings and make up towns and make up places because I don't want to be constrained by the post office is there and the church is there. I just like to put the post office where I need it. But you found that actually, those things really started it for you, brought it to life.
It really made it possible for me. And I think this is partly, you know, perhaps my background as a television documentary maker. And in a way, I was assembling this story in the way that I might a documentary, with footage of things that I'd seen that were running through my head and information that I'd gained from books and from talking to people. I spoke to a few people, not many people still alive who were in Lambsdorff, but I spoke to people, read memoirs, published and unpublished. My dad's best friend had left a diary, which the family allowed me to read, so that I was pulling on all of these resources. And one of my students, when I was teaching creative writing, once said to me they thought a writer was like a recycling centre. And I think that's exactly what I was doing. I had all of this material at my disposal. And though I was making up the characters are entirely invented. I was then being able to ground them by standing them in a place that I'd seen and smelt and touched. And that for me made it possible to combine all those things into the finished novel.
So you taught creative writing at Middlesex University, didn't you, for
30 years.
30 years, yeah. How did that feed into your writing? How has that informed your writing, that teaching experience?
I think everything you do informs your writing, doesn't it? So I don't think somebody has to have taken a course or taught a course in order to understand more about writing. But certainly, you know, the number of times that I said to students, well, okay, whose point of view is this in, has kind of ingrained into me information about using points of view. The number of times that I've said to people, well, I don't think you've got the right point of entry here. You know, is this really where this story begins? Or does it begin sooner? Or does it begin later? So I think all of that has been useful in helping me construct my work, more in terms of structure, I would say, than in terms of style, because I think style is very personal. I think it's to do with that voice that's in your head. I think my own poetry and the development of my poetry contributed to my voice. Had quite a lot of tussles with my editor about my use of metaphor and simile and whether there was too many in there and whether they needed to come out. I loved teaching creative writing. I loved being with people who were making work, and think that was a huge privilege in my life. And it's hard to know what you've picked up from where. When people ask you about your influences, it's always hard to know exactly what you've got from a certain place. But I was very fortunate to have had that experience.
And once you got the manuscript, all that work, all that research, all that writing, the narrative poem, and then years later the novel, what happened after that?
Okay, well, I've told you about the novels under my bed, which I tried to sell and failed to. And it looked for quite a long time as though that was going to be the fate of The Prisoner's Wife, or The Girl Made of Silence, as it then was. I knew this was a brilliant story. Whether I had done justice to it or not wasn't for me to say. That was for somebody else to say. So I had written a number of drafts before I allowed people to read it. And then I had good friends and family who gave me further feedback. Didn't understand this, didn't know what was happening there, what about this? And then I started to send it out to agents, because I didn't have an agent. Poetry doesn't make enough money for most people for agents to be interested. And so I started to send it to agents, and some said, frustratingly, oh, there are some brilliant chapters, but didn't tell me which. Some said, yes, I love it, but I don't handle commercial work. Some didn't reply. I found one in New York, and she sent me back 4 pages of really, really useful suggestions and ideas. And I then reworked it again following that, sent it back to her, and she said, no, it's still not working for me. So that didn't happen. But it was a better novel. It was a better novel each time. And serendipity comes into this so many times, not only in terms of me meeting Sidney Reed in a lift and getting this story, but also I had one of my favourite writers was Helen Dunmore. Great admirer of her poetry, great admirer of her fiction. And, you know, some of her books are among my favourite ever books. And so I thought, well, OK, I'm going to try Helen Dunmore's agent. Wrote to Helen Dunmore's agent, got a letter back or an email back saying that he wasn't taking on any new people, but his assistant was taking on new people. Would I send them the novel? Sent them the novel and didn't hear anything for 6 months, and thought, OK, it's not going to happen. In the meantime, had sent it to these American people who'd given me lots of tips and improved it quite a lot. Then thought, hang on a minute, she was quite keen. I'm going to try and find her again. Emailed her again and said, did you receive the manuscript I sent you? And she emailed back immediately and said, no, never arrived. I've checked my junk mail. It's not here. Never arrived. And it was in my sent box. I do not know what happened to that in the interim. So I was then able to send her a later draft. This was Millie Hoskins at United Agents, who got back to me immediately and said, yes, I love it, let's talk about it, and seemed pretty sure that she could sell it. So tremendous excitement. Although she knows this, I've said this to her. I said to her, oh, her name's Millie. That means she's going to be about 25. She's probably too young. She probably doesn't know whether she can sell this or not. So went and met her and absolutely loved her. And she then said to me, okay, before I try and sell this book, I'd like you to take 30,000 words out of it. So I went away, I killed a lot of my darlings, took out 30,000 words, and then sent it back to her. And I didn't say, she was the 21st agent I had sent it to. So an awful lot of perseverance and keeping going and thinking, I do know this is a good story. She then sent it to Penguin Random House, to Helen Dunmore's editor, who got back with a preemptive bid immediately, overnight, within 24 hours. I had a preemptive bid. Then I spent a few hours where Millie said to me, we can put this out to auction on Monday, or you've got till this afternoon to decide if you want to take this preemptive bid. So as a person who'd never been paid any kind of advance and had to phone my dear writer friends and say, what does it mean? What should I do? I've got no idea about all of this. Suddenly I had an offer, and the fact that Selina Walker was Helen Dunmore's editor, I thought, well, I'm going to be getting the best person I could ask for. So I don't want anybody else. I don't want, you know, some bright young man straight out of Oxbridge who might offer more money. That's not what I want. I want Selina. And that's who I had. And, you know, it was marvellous as a result.
Amazing. And now the novel, how many countries is it published in now?
I don't know whether when you're doing that, because I'm new to all this, really. I don't know whether when you're doing that, you count the sort of, the fact that it was out in the UK means it was also out in New Zealand and Australia and South Africa and India. And the fact that it was out in the USA meant it was also out in Canada. So if you count all of those...
Quite a lot of English-speaking countries to start with.
Yeah, absolutely.
How many other languages?
Eight other languages, of which the strangest was the Sri Lankan offer. That came from sort of, okay, where's that come from?
Yeah.
And obviously Eastern European, Polish, Hungarian, Czech, and then other European languages.
What surprised you most about this process of having a novel go out into the world in this way?
Gosh, so many things have surprised me. You have to understand that as a poet, most of my book sales would be at readings. So I would come home from a reading and say, oh, I sold 4 books. That would be good. That would be excellent. I'd be very happy with that. So the fact that I've got, you know, almost immediately after I'd got the Century, the Penguin Random House offer in the UK, it was sold into the States to another imprint of Penguin Random House in New York. So to be able to say, oh, well, you know, my New York editor says this, that was all rather fun. What surprised me most, I think, is still the fact that people like what I've written. I'm not surprised they like the story, because I always knew it was a great story. But the fact that it is suddenly a monetized thing is pretty peculiar to me, and that people are talking about, you know, you get this much money for these number that you sell, and then the royalties go up to this, and that all seems pretty strange to me, really.
Now, as a poet, you've always been, I think, quite involved in activism in one way or another. Certainly, in the time I've known you, that's been the case. I think shortly after we met, you were organising a poemathon for refugees, and you've also been very involved with climate activism. And Poets for the Planet is an organisation you're involved with. What place does poetry have in activism?
Well, I absolutely do not agree with the idea that poetry changes nothing. I think it can change things. It can change people's attitudes. It can... It's about perspective again, isn't it? It can allow people, as fiction can, to step into another shoe and or pair of shoes and see the world in a different way. So I do think poetry has a big part to play in changing things. And it's always very interesting, isn't it, where there are oppressive regimes, the writers, the journalists, the novelists and the poets are the people who are first stifled, because they do have things to say and they do have ways to say it that are universal. You know, I think right through all my work, through my documentaries making and my poetry and fiction, there are themes that one sees that you return to. I'm obviously very interested in women's perspective in the world, having really come of age during second wave feminism and seeing how long it's taken us to get as far as we've got. That really interests me, in taking a female perspective on things. I think being the child of a man who fought in the Second World War, and my mum was a nurse, but she was a pacifist, has given me a real sense of the horror and futility of war. So through a lot of my poetry and obviously The Prisoner's Wife, you know, that was the message that I was keen to get home. And in terms of, I think I've always been a bit of a campaigner. I was a big CND person, anti-Margaret Thatcher marches, and always felt that one person could make a change, and it may not be big, but it would be part of a bigger thing. So I think then the thought that poetry could be part of that as well. In terms of the Poets for the Planet, obviously environmental concerns should affect us all. We should all be shouting as loud as we can about what we need to do to preserve this amazing planet. And I became very interested in, as so many people did, in the refugee crisis, and thinking about, well, if I didn't have the quality of life that I have now, and I saw that people over the water there had it, I would want to take my children there. Of course I would. And then the horrific stories of Syrian refugees were so, well, touching's the wrong word, but I felt I wanted to do something, and I came across some people in Enfield who were setting up a refugee welcome scheme, and I made a donation like you do, and then I thought, now hang on a minute, I can do better than this. It was a wonderful poet called Jacqueline Safra who had done the first poemathon a little while previously, and you wouldn't think that a marathon poetry reading would attract anything, let alone money, but she'd come up with this brilliant idea where poets leapfrog one another in a reading, and each of those people raise money, get sponsorship. So I decided I would do the same thing for the Enfield Welcome Refugees group, and we raised nearly £15,000from one day's of poetry reading, which was astonishing, absolutely astonishing. And since then I've been doing work with Poets for the Planet, which is also started by Jacqueline Safra, and she has done poemathons, which I've taken part in. I then thought, well, I want to do some fundraising, and put on various fundraising events where we did readings, and then thought it would be a good idea if we had a little pamphlet to sell at this. So got the people who were doing readings with me to send some poems, and my long-suffering husband did the layout and the design of the pamphlet. So we had a pamphlet to sell, so that raised more money. So I think it's just about thinking, what can I do? What do I know how to do? And I know lots of people, and I like event organising. It does something that doesn't faze me. And hopefully events will be back and we will be able to do more things without COVID. So,
well, that's right, because the pandemic, in fact, The Prisoner's Wife came out during lockdown, didn't it, in 2020. What was that experience like?
Well, you can see my face. You can see my downturned mouth. It was not what I had hoped for and expected. I had this little dream of myself walking through an airport and past Smith's and seeing a little pile of the prisoner's wife there in the airport. I had a launch, or in fact, I had two book launches organised, one in Daunt Books in Marylebone, and you know, would be again walking past a pile of my books and sitting and signing, and another launch organised in Harbour Books in Whitstable. And of course, none of that happened. So we had one of the first Zoom events that I've attended. I had been at one previously, which was actually a Poets for the Planet event, and everybody was kind of reading up, how do we do Zoom? How will it work? So we looked that up, and everybody downloaded Zoom, and that was lovely in its own way, because it meant that my US publisher and all the publicists there, my marketeers, they're called, I love that, were able to be there at the launch, which they wouldn't have been in Daunt Books. Friends from all over the country and around the world. The Dutch publisher was able to be there and so on. So that was lovely in its own way. But then, of course, there were no bookshops open. So incredibly frustrating. It even dropped off Amazon for a while because the Amazon warehouses were only taking in new things that were to do with all the PPE that everybody wanted. They were focused. They said, books are less important. How dare they? Waterstones distribution wasn't working properly, so friends who'd ordered it didn't get it. But I was very lucky. When I was first told that my novel was a commercial novel, not a literary novel, there's a little prickle that goes on where you think, oh, I thought I'd written a literary novel. But thank God I hadn't, because the fact that it was commercial and that had a really good marketing people meant that it was on sale in Asda and Tesco's. And so the hardbacks were sold mostly through supermarkets. Also, of course, through, Goldsborough Books and people, and online sales, but particularly through the supermarkets.
And the pandemic has posed all sorts of challenges for writers, hasn't it? I mean, I know some writers who've had to abandon novels because they feel completely unbelievable now, characters doing all sorts of outlandish things like shaking hands and hugging each other. Do you think it will be reflected in your writing? Is it going to, in your poetry or in your fiction work? How is it going to affect?
I think it allows me to engage imaginatively with people in situations that are not of their making. So I think that if the next book is also based in some war kind of experience, it's the fact that we can't, you know, during a pandemic, you can't plan. All your plans are lost. You're no longer able to do that. And suddenly I understood for the first time what it was like for my parents. War is declared, and so you can't say, oh, we could go to Rill for a holiday. No, you can't do that anymore. You can't do anything you want to do anymore. Your life has been completely taken over by this thing. So I think in terms of that, it's sort of helpful to me. I think in terms of, you know, as many of my friends who are writers have said, well, what they did during the pandemic was not that different from what they did otherwise. They read and they wrote. So my daily life would be still to do my yoga, go to my study, do my research, do my writing, whatever it was that I was working on, go for my 1 hour's walk that I was allowed, come home and read a book. So apart from the horrible thing of not being able to see your children and not being able to hug your friends, a lot of the sort of timetable of the day is pretty similar, really.
And what advice would you have for a young writer setting out now with all your experience and the things you've been through and all different kinds of writing that you've been engaged with? What would you say to someone who's just taking their first steps?
I would say try to believe in yourself. Try to learn as much as you can. you know, nobody is a writer who isn't a reader. So you have to be reading whatever it is you're trying to do. You have to be absorbing tons and tons of that stuff. You know, if you want to write a screenplay, watch movies. If you want to write rap, listen to rap. You know, you've got to be engaging with everything that's gone before. And partly so that you don't accidentally repeat what people have done before, but also you're just imbibing it. And writing is like other skills. There's this famous, you know, you've got to do something for 10,000 hours before you get good at it. You just have to keep doing it and reading what other people do. So like being a musician or like being a footballer, you have to see how other people do it and then keep doing it. And if you get to a point where you think, I love doing this, but I can see that I perhaps don't have a place in the published world, then that's fine. What's wrong with that? People paint for themselves. They make music for themselves. Why could you not write for yourself just for the pleasure and the enjoyment and the understanding that you gain from the way that you understand your own mind, the way you understand your own place in the world? You know, all of that is valuable, even if it doesn't lead to publication.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for making the time to talk to me, Maggie. It's been wonderful.
Great pleasure, Anne.
That was Maggie Butt in conversation with Anne Morgan. You can find out more about Maggie on her website at www.maggiebutt.co.uk. That's Butt with two T's. And that concludes episode 348, which was recorded by Anne Morgan and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 349, Laura Barnett speaks with Anne Morgan about capturing moments, the power of detail, and holding on to the book you want to write. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.